The French composer Maurice Ravel died 50 years ago this year. Among his compositions was one he called An Experiment in a Very Special and Limited Direction, consisting wholly of orchestral tissue without music. It was the last purely orchestral work he wrote. And tonight's Kaleidoscope looks at this musical legacy from the point of view of those who have to perform it, often again and again.
One morning at Saint-Jean-de-Luz, Ravel went to the piano. He was wearing a yellow dressing gown and a scarlet bathing cap. We were just going for a swim. He picked out a melody with one finger. Madame Rubinstein has asked me for a ballet. Don't you think this theme has an insistent quality about it? I shall try and repeat it a number of times without any development whatsoever.
And he did. Ravel's Bolero was performed by Ida Rubinstein and her ballet company in November 1928, and it quickly became the composer's most popular work. It still is, and the orchestra who face up to it are still challenged by its very special and limited direction. The conductor, Bramwell Tovey.
The very first time I ever did it with a professional orchestra, I got up on stage and I looked round. There were sort of 8 or 10 cellists on my right and violas all poised with finger, ready to sort of pizzicato the first notes of the accompaniment. And in the middle distance somewhere was this side drummer looking absolutely sort of mortified at the thought that he was going to have to play, I don't know, whatever it is, 582 bars of the same rhythm.
Gary Cattell, percussion.
Being the drummer, if you're the main drummer, and you started off, it's actually very nerve-wracking because it's only 2 bars, but you know everybody knows it. So if you get the pearlies or something, then you mess it up. I mean, you feel rotten.
You get up in the morning, you've got this thing at the back of your mind all day that, you know, about 10 o'clock time, you've got to play this thing.
Malcolm Framingham, trombone.
I feel very nervous, to be absolutely honest about it, and it's as long as 45 seconds I ever have to play.
It's a more or less Hammer name to us. It's a horror, you see, because I personally believe it's a fantastic leg pull, the whole thing.
Jack Brimer, clarinet and saxophone.
We all know the famous trombone bit that no one can get right at all. Then come other little things like the initial clarinet solo, which is all a succession of legato, C-sharps and B-naturals, which the clarinet can't do. But there are one or two brilliant bits like the wonderful harmonic on the piccolo. The rest of it is rubbish.
This image of the hardened professional musician who says, what the hell are we playing tonight and who the hell's conducting it? You know, in 30 years, I've hardly ever found that to be true. There are plenty of people who put out that impression, but underneath, it's very rarely true.
John Ludlow, orchestra leader.
It may be your 20th Bolero of the year, but once you sit there and there's an audience in front of you, it does change.
Last year, I think I did something like 30 performances. And you think, oh no, not another one.
Dave White, clarinet and saxophone.
On the other hand, it's a very curious piece. It produces more fear, I think, amongst players than almost any other piece I know. As soon as players hear that side drum start, for many of them, it's like a walk to the scaffold, I think.
Now that 2-bar phrase is played 169 times. There is no rest whatever.
James Blades, percussion.
And it's quite a challenge to a percussionist because it is a very steady crescendo.
You can go right, left, right, left, right, left, right, hand to hand, alternate. Or some people do it right, 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 left, right, 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 left, right, right. The way I do it is right, 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 right. The first time I did it, at the Albert Hall. It's the left hand can sometimes have a bit of a twitch if you're a bit nervous, especially having to play that bit very quietly. So I thought, well, I'm going to do this, and I've got both the sticks ready. And I kind of, as he lifted his baton for the downbeat, I bottled out and actually ended up playing it with one hand, just the right hand. And actually, funnily enough, last time I did it like that at the Barbican, everyone looked across and says, blimey, look, he's doing it one hand. You know, and actually, it's easier. It's no big deal to do it like that, you know.
You have 4 bars of introduction with the side drum and the pizzicato, and then it's all yours.
Margaret Campbell, flute.
It needs to be terribly calm, very quiet and very controlled. It's very lonely moments, I must say, very lonely.
Obviously, a lot of extra players involved for the bolero, so we're all able to go on at once, and then the conductor will come back on, and then the drum will start. There's no going back. You think, oh dear, I could have turned this concert down if I...
I'm very focused on the instrument and myself and the conductor.
David Corkill, percussion.
And very much aware of that first beat of the conductor, because sometimes they just like to be terribly, terribly subtle about it, or very clever or whatever, and hardly give you any beat at all. I've seen it happen. And you have to be very much on the QV and hope he doesn't start without you.
The most important moment in Bolero is the upbeat, just before you start. And I actually don't like to use a baton because I feel that what possible contribution can a baton make to the opening bars of Bolero? The best thing to do is just set the tempo as calmly as you can.
You set the whole thing off, set the ball rolling. So if you don't play it in a very stylish way, it's rather disappointing. You have to be careful, as a flute player, not to be breathing too often, otherwise it spoils the line.
I had a very terrifying experience. I played my four bars and the flute player hadn't arrived. Neither had his friend, the second flute player. I thought, well, there's only one thing to do, keep going. And I actually played that 24 times before the orchestra began to come in.
Players go on quests for the bolero snare drum. You know, people go to shops asking for small drums and say they've suddenly discovered one in a junk shop. The ideal bolero snare drum, which is capable of playing very quietly and yet very, very crisply at the edge. It has to be quite a small, crisp sound at the very beginning. So the normal course of events for a snare drummer is to begin the work very near the edge of the snare drum, and as the work progresses, move a little bit more towards the centre.
As far as the strings are concerned, it starts off in the lower end, the violas, cellos, bass, simply with a very gentle pom, pim, pom, pom, pim, pom, 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 this sort of thing going on, simply adding a little gentle rhythmic pulse. This pulsing from the low pizzicatos at the beginning is totally vital. It's a part of the colour, but it's also part of the very, very subtle type of rhythmic insinuation on which the whole work is built.
This piece has so many effects. It can be hypnotic, it can be a steady, almost Rossini-like crescendo. It is, in many respects, one of the first examples of minimalism. Basically, we've got two tunes. How on earth did he come up with this concept of just using two tunes? I don't think anybody else could have orchestrated this piece. I don't think anybody else would have had the technique or the courage. He's a very courageous orchestrator. He goes for things in all his scores that on paper look absolutely ridiculous, and yet they invariably tend to come off.
In the upper strings, we normally play these pizzicatos in the banjo position, with the violin or the viola tucked under the arm. Because, in fact, some of the pizzicatos are very complicated chord patterns. Rather difficult to do, in fact. So even one or two chords written that are quite impossible to play. Nobody bothers, because you can't hear the exact detail of these things anyway. But to play them in the position as a banjo is played is actually considerably easier, as long as you remember then to bring the instrument up into the position under the chin by the time you need to have it in that position. Can be rather embarrassing otherwise if you make a sudden dive in the only two bars rest that are left to you before you use the bow. If you suddenly try to turn the thing around the other way and pick the bow up at the same moment, there might be some nasty accidents.
The difficult thing about performing it is the ability to play the tune. You've got flute, clarinet, bassoon, E-flat clarinet, oboe d'amore, trumpet and flute, tenor sax, sopranino sax, soprano sax, trombone, all these individuals are actually playing the tune. Fortunately, as a conductor, you don't play any wrong notes.
A lot of conductors, sort of, as soon as they see anybody holding a saxophone in an orchestra, I think, start to panic. I think they regard them as sort of some Darwinian subspecies or something, or at the very best, a drug-taking jazz musician who's going to improvise a solo when it comes to his turn. So you generally find that whatever else happens, it'll make the saxophones rehearse. You're always backstage here, trombone players playing all the time. You know. In fact, if you go backstage during a rehearsal or a concert, you can always hear bits of Bolero. It's quite frustrating sometimes.
Suddenly it's a colour, it's in octaves for the first time. The flute and trumpet version of the melody, and two people are playing the melody.
With the saxophone, at the start of the previous solo for trumpet and flute, you're starting to worry now about what's coming up. You put the instrument to your lips, you make sure the reed's wet, and you start worrying about that first note you've got to play. If you hit it too hard or you don't play it quite loudly enough, you know you're in trouble.
It's a lovely moment always when the sax comes in, because you can't really go wrong with a tenor sax. I mean, it has to be in the hands of a complete idiot to sound awful. I mean, it's the way it lies at the top of the register on the written C natural D and E flat. I mean, they're such wonderful notes on the fourth bar.
In this piece, we are totally under the control of the percussion section. A conductor could do what on earth he liked, but if the percussion section decided that they were not going to go that way, the performance would go with the percussion section, not with the conductor. Because ultimately, we are controlled by sound more than by sight.
I was in a performance once with a conductor whose name I won't mention, but there's nothing much for the conductor to do, apart from maybe cue a trombone or a saxophone or whatever. And it's very easy for a conductor to follow the tune and just let it go its wistful way. And it was on this sort of occasion, this particular conductor, instead of listening to the snare drum or maybe just carrying on with his normal technical beat, he's followed the tune too much. He ended up on the wrong part of the bar. So his downbeat was now on the second beat of the bar. And instead of being like this, dum, da, 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 dum, and da, three, and one, and da, two, it's more like this. Three, and da, two, and da, one, and three, and da, two. This great dilemma faced me. You know, my mind was literally in two minds, whether to play as I was continuing to play or to go with the conductor. And of course, I had to continue playing as I was playing. I mean, I daren't look at the conductor, so I kept my eyes down and looked up from time to time to see if he'd got himself to go. No. So I looked down again. And it went on for many, many minutes. Eventually, we ended up together. But it was a frightening moment.
It's like a huge edifice. You take out one of the foundation bricks and the whole thing begins to fall apart. And this can happen at any moment, either when somebody cracks a note or slips a bar or gets a beat ahead or hurries and the drummer has to catch him up and the rest of the orchestra doesn't, or when somebody who's been just sitting dreaming, waiting for his turn, either comes in one turn too early or one turn too late. Or, in point of fact, the whole rhythm having to carry on without anybody playing. And this can easily happen in this work.
There's a great moment when two piccolos, a very high French horn, and Celeste come in. And you can look over and you can see this poor Celeste player. It's probably the only thing he's played in the concert. He's probably sat around for 3 hours at the rehearsal just in case it's done. And he's probably just accompanied somebody in a very difficult, intricate work on Radio 3. And he turns up at the concert and he plays something that, quite frankly, could be played by any Grade 1 pianist. Once, when I looked over to the Celeste, he was absolutely miles away. Not with it at all. He just completely missed it. And he was just about to come in at 9 with the oboes and cor anglais when he'd realised what he'd done. And I just missed the whole thing. You know, he probably collected his fee, 35 quid, and said thank you very much and disappeared. I mean, normally it would work out at about 20 pence a note, but on this occasion it was £35 for sitting there. But the Celeste certainly adds flavour and colour to the horn line, and just, I mean, it just matches against the piccolo beautifully. It's a great moment, actually. You've got the tune in three keys all of a sudden. You've got one piccolo playing very high in E major, We've got a lower piccolo playing high in G major. We've got a horn playing the melody in C major. And what a great moment there, what a brilliant idea. Solo, suddenly you're back for the last time to one instrumentalist. And sometimes this can be a weak point because the trombone player doesn't really take over there. It's very high, it's very difficult. And sometimes I get a little worried if I see a strange face playing the trombone because you don't like to see a trombone player doing it for the first time when you're conducting.
The thing is, if you do too much playing, then you, what we call, blow our lip out. And it's not fresh. And at the end of the day, you just have to... what we call screw it on, you know, you've got to produce the goods. I take it from when the trumpet first plays, it's always worked. I've always come in at the right place. After that, there are four tunes that come, and then it's the trombone's turn, and then I then play. There was one story I heard of one trombone player that didn't really want to play it. And before everybody sort of turned up for the rehearsal, but the music was out on the stands, he went round and marked cut, which just means to miss out that particular section, you see. And he marked that on all the parts of the whole orchestra. So his solo was cut.
One of the lessons you're taught when you're a youngster is, as you get louder, don't get faster. Keep your speed when you get louder. And by and large, that works incredibly well. When it came to Bolero, I mean, I must say that I find the final sections, I've done the piece, I dread to think how many times now, I find the final sections really don't work at the same tempo that you set at the beginning. For my money, there has to be just a very slight, gentle acceleration to maintain the momentum all the way through.
When the excitement starts to rise, it's probably the pulse begins to move a little bit faster in the listener. So if the music stays at exactly the same tempo, it'll probably appear to the listener to be slightly slower. And the greatest skill, I think, for the conductor is to know just how to edge that tempo a tiny bit from beginning to end. Now, this is a little secret which I was very, very happy to be let into by a marvellous Frenchman, Manuel Rosenthal. He had been a pupil of Ravel, and he told me the secret that Ravel had told him about it. Two things. First of all, never to let any long note diminuendo, so that from beginning to end, no sound ever got less. And the other element was fractionally to push the tempo. It must never be obvious to an audience that it's moved at all.
The point is that it's almost hypnotic in the insistence of the rhythm. It keeps on belting away and getting louder. But, you know, if you want an orchestral crescendo, which is done by adding instruments as he does it, it's a perfectly good device to start pianissimo and finish fortissimo. If you want that done really decently, Elgar does it much better than his Nimrod. Whereas this is rather like being hit behind the ear with a sock full of wet sand all the time. It's somebody thumping away at you. And I suppose it's a sort of frenzy that does happen, but I could do without it myself, easily.
I like hypnotic-type music anyway. The fact that it is the same rhythm gives me a buzz, you know. And it's just a fabulous example of very well-controlled build-up in texture. What we quite often do is we get the second drummer to start earlier than like indicated in the score, just to lend a bit of weight a bit sooner, because actually the second snare drum comes in quite near the end.
It depends. If we're having a good time, we might say to them, hey, join in now, mate, you know.
By the time the strings take it over, it's in very thick harmonic writing. The violin parts are divided into four, so that instead of having a simple line, you've got line with harmony, very much like the saxophone writing in the dance bands of the 1940s, 1950s, where it's all thick, close harmonic writing. That's exactly what we have in the upper string parts. So this gives this terrific thick feeling to it all.
The most extraordinary performance I did was at the National Exhibition Centre in Birmingham, a gala performance with Simon Rattle, which was with the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra and for live television. For the Bolero, which finished the concert, they decided to have a laser show. It was in the middle of the summer, so it was already extremely hot. It was really wild. TV lights and these incredibly hot laser lights on top. It was absolutely boiling. Because it's so hot, I had a thin strap top, and the dry ice was coming up by then. I saw it on the video, and he got a sort of it caught my shoulder, which was glistening with sweat. I thought, oh my goodness, that does look steamy. But then it is a steamy sort of piece.
There's this great moment. Everybody's playing for the very first time. And everybody is really going hammer and tongs by this point, except the Celeste player, who's folded his arms by then.
The timpani play on a boom, 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 boom. Pom, accompanying the tom, tickety-tom, pom, pom, tickety-tom. It's all quite a frolic.
The rhythm's going hell for leather. The harpist is probably trying not to drown everybody. And then suddenly at the end, we lurch. I mean, lurch is the only word I can think of. We lurch into E major. And you've got this fantastic clash in the bass line. Such a surprise.
That is the moment that I must say, does give you a terrific lift. Even when you've played it for 20, 30 times, it still gives you a lift when you come to that moment. And not simply because you know that you're near to the end. The two conflicting elements of the monotony of the same thing happening time and time again, but the built-up excitement of the persistent rhythm. Those two things are suddenly released when you get that change of chord.
He just changes the tune very slightly before the lurch. It's on an offbeat. Ba-da-da, bee, bum, dee-dee-dee, bum, bee. We're in the new key. We're not there for very long, and suddenly we lurch again back into the original key.
6 bars before the end, Ravel then brings in the tam-tam. The large gong, the bass drum, and the cymbals.
It's so clever that he uses those percussion instruments just at that moment.
The tam-tam is a double 40. One must really go to town with it. The sound of metal is a wonderful sound.
It goes bass drum, cymbals, tam-tam, boom. Tsh. It's got to be like that. You can't go boom. Tsh. Because it'd be late.
We've got everybody on this rhythm. We've got glissandi for the trombones. It's not coarse or anything, it's just beautifully pointing the rhythm.
Normally, the conductor wants that as loud as possible. Brah, 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 brah.
And then the extraordinary side slip feel of where the whole thing, almost like a building collapsing.
During the second beat of the penultimate bar, there is no rhythm at all, there's just one sustained note. Ba-da-la, nothing happens, and suddenly you get ba-da-da-da-da-da. Nobody can believe it's finished. Ravel studiously writes two crotchet bars rest, which the audience observe, and then suddenly there's a sort of eruption. I wonder if a large portion of the audience have that fantastic picture where Christine throws down Jane Torval as his cape and she spins around on the ice. I can't help feeling that half the audience are thinking about that. Perhaps they've come for that moment. Perhaps everybody else has come for the moment where, like knocking your head against a brick wall, it finally stops. What a great moment that is at the end. I wonder what Ravel really meant. I wonder what he meant by the whole piece.
Immediately the thing is finished, there is actually a sense of relief. And that is the essential function that the applause plays to us. That releases tension. And we then relax.
It's rewarding if you've played well. If it hasn't gone well, or if perhaps one's been less than satisfied, or it's been less than one hoped, then you mightn't feel so good about it. But if it's a good performance, it's a terrific feeling. One feels on top of the world.
It takes me quite a long time to unwind. Normally, you sort of go back into the band room and we have a bit of a joke and whatever, and you tend to unwind that way. And by the time you've got out of the car park, you know, 20 minutes later, then you think, what was all that about?
I feel I want to go home. I really believe it is the last thing on any programme, and I think that is it. I don't hate this work. I don't even dislike it. I'm mildly amused by it, because it's the sheer impertinence of a genius of this sort to put this in front of the public and make orchestral players do it that seems to me to be quite completely outrageous.
As soon as you've finished, if you've done it well, which you know better than anybody whether you have, you feel pretty chuffed, especially when the other lads say, well done, Gary, you know, or well done, mate, or something, and you feel chuffed and then you get a bow and then you have a laugh about it, you know. Then you might put a bit of gear away, fold the snare drum stand up, pick your sticks up, go off. In person, I always change. I can't actually go out of the hall in like a dinner suit or a tail suit or anything. I just change into civvies, if you like. And then go and have a couple of pints. Perhaps a curry later.
The conductor, Paul Paré, remembered taking Ravel to the casino at Monte Carlo. As they went through the gaming room, Paré asked him if he would like a gamble. Ravel replied, I wrote Bolero and won. I'll stick there.
Tonight's kaleidoscope, Tum tididit tum tididit tum tum, featured Bramall Tovey as the conductor and John Ludlow as orchestra leader, with James Blades, David Corkill and Gary Cattell on percussion, Jack Brimer and Dave White on clarinet and saxophone, Malcolm Framingham on trombone, and Margaret Campbell on flute. Backing them up in a performance on record was the Montreal Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Charles Dutoit. The reader was André Morin. Technical presentation was by Group 5 studio managers, and the programme was produced by Richard Bannerman.